brought to you by Penguin.
Wrong Place, Wrong Time, a novel by Gillian McAllister, read by Leslie Sharp. Day zero, just after midnight. Jen is glad of the clocks going back tonight. A gained hour, extra time, to be spent pretending she isn't waiting up for her son. Now that it is past midnight, it is officially the 30th of October, almost Halloween. Jen tells herself that Todd is 18, her September baby, now an adult. He can do whatever he wants. She has spent much of the evening badly carving a pumpkin. She places it now on the sill of the picture window that overlooks their driveway and lights it. She only carved it for the same reason she does most things, because she felt she should. But it's actually quite beautiful in its own jagged way. She hears her husband Kelly's feet on the landing above hers and turns to look. It's unusual for him to be up, he the lark and she the nightingale. He emerges from their bedroom on the top floor. His hair is messy, blue-black in the dimness. He has on not a single piece of clothing, only a small, amused smile, which he blows out of the side of his mouth. He descends the stairs towards her. His wrist tattoo catches the light, an inscribed date, the day he says he knew he loved her, spring 2003. Jen looks at his body. Just a few of his dark chest hairs have turned white over the past year, his 43rd. Been busy? He gestures to the pumpkin. Everyone had done one, Jen explains lamely, all the neighbours. Who cares? He says. Classic Kelly. Todd's not back. It's the early evening for him, he says. Soft Welsh accent, just barely detectable on the three-syllable evening. Like his breath is stumbling over a mountain range. Isn't it 1 o'clock, his curfew? It's a typical exchange for them. Jen cares very much, Kelly perhaps too little. Just as she thinks this, he turns, and there it is, his perfect, perfect arse that she's loved for almost 20 years. She gazes back down at the street, looking for Todd, then back at Kelly. The neighbours can now see your arse, she says. They'll think it's another pumpkin, he says, his wit as fast and sharp as the slice of a knife. Banter. It's always been their currency. Come to bed? Can't believe Merrylocks is done, he adds with a stretch. He's been restoring a Victorian tiled floor at a house on Merrylocks Road all week. Working alone, exactly the way Kelly likes it. He listens to podcast after podcast, hardly ever sees anyone. Complicated. Kind of unfulfilled. That's Kelly. Sure, she says. In a bit, I just want to know he's home, okay? He'll be here any minute now, kebab in hand. Kelly waves a hand. You waiting up for the chips? Stop, Jen says with a smile. Kelly winks and retreats to bed. Jen wanders aimlessly around the house. She thinks about a case she has on at work, a divorcing couple arguing primarily over a set of china plates, but of course, really, over a betrayal. She shouldn't have taken it on. She has over 300 cases already, but Mrs. Vishar had looked at Jen in that first meeting and said, "If I have to give him those plates, I will have lost every single thing I love." And Jen hadn't been able to resist. She wishes she didn't care so much. About divorcing strangers, about neighbours, about bloody pumpkins. But she does. She makes a tea and takes it back up to the picture window, continuing her vigil. She'll wait as long as it takes. Both phases of parenthood, the newborn years and the almost adult ones, are bookended by sleep deprivation, though for different reasons. They bought this house because of this window in the exact centre of their three-storey house. We'd look out of it like kings, Jen had said, while Kelly laughed. She stares out into the October mist, and there is Todd, outside on the street, at last. Jen sees him just as daylight saving time kicks in and her phone switches from 0159 to 0100. She hides a smile. Thanks to the clocks going back, he is deliberately no longer late. That's Todd for you. He finds the linguistic and semantic backflipping of arguing a curfew more important than the reason for it. He is loping up the street. He's skin and bones, doesn't ever seem to gain weight. His knees poke angles in his jeans as he walks. The mist outside is colourless, the trees and pavement black, the air a translucent white. A world in greyscale. Their street, the back end of Crosby, Merseyside, is unlit. Kelly installed a Narnia-style lamp outside their house. He surprised her with it, wrought iron, expensive. She has no idea how he afforded it. It clicks on as it detects movement. But, wait, Todd's seen something. He stops dead, squints. Jen follows his gaze and then she sees it too, a figure hurrying along the street from the other side. He is older than Todd, much older. She can tell by his body, his movements. Jen notices things like this, always has. It is what makes her a good lawyer. She places a hot palm on the cool glass of the window. Something is wrong. Something is about to happen. Jen is sure of this without being able to name what it is, some instinct for danger, the same way she feels around fireworks and level crossings and cliff edges. The thoughts rush through her mind like the clicking of a camera, one after the other after the other. She sets the mug on the windowsill, calls Kelly, then rushes down the stairs two at a time, the striped runner rough on her bare feet. She throws on shoes, then pauses for a second with her hand on the metal front doorknob. What's that feeling? She can't explain it. Is it déjà vu? She hardly ever experiences it. She blinks and the feeling is gone, as insubstantial as smoke. What was it? Her hand on the brass knob? The yellow lamp shining outside? No, she can't recall. It's gone now. What? Kelly says, appearing behind her, tying a grey dressing gown around his waist. Todd, he's out there with someone. They hurry out. The autumn cold chills her skin immediately. Jen runs towards Todd and the stranger. But before she's even realized what is happening, Kelly's shouted out, "Stop!" Todd is running and within seconds has the front of this stranger's hooded coat in his grasp. He is squaring up to him, his shoulders thrust forwards, their bodies together. The stranger reaches a hand into his pocket. Kelly is running towards them, looking panicked, his eyes going left and right, up and down the street. "Todd, no," he says, and that's when Jen sees the knife. Adrenaline sharpens her vision as she sees it happen, a quick, clean stab. And then everything slows way down. The movement of the arm pulling back, the clothing resisting, then releasing the knife. Two white feathers emerge with the blade, drifting aimlessly in the frozen air, like snowflakes. Jen stares as blood begins to spurt, huge amounts of it. She must be kneeling down now, because she becomes aware of the little stones of the path cutting round divots into her knees. She's cradling him, parting his jacket, feeling the heat of the blood as it surges down her hands, between her fingers, along her wrists. She undoes his shirt, his torso begins to flood, the three coin-slot wounds swim in and out of view. It's like trying to see the bottom of a red pond. She has gone completely cold.
"No!"
Her voice is thick and wet as she screams. "Jen," Kelly says hoarsely. There's so much blood. She lays him on her driveway and leans over, looking carefully. She hopes she's wrong, but she's sure, for just a moment, that he isn't here anymore. The way the yellowed lamplight hits his eyes isn't quite right. The night is completely silent. And after what must be several minutes, she blinks in shock, then looks up at her son. Kelly has moved Todd away from the victim and has his arms wrapped around him. Kelly's back is to her, Todd facing her, just gazing down at her over his father's shoulder, his expression neutral. He drops the knife. It rings out like a church bell as the metal hits the frozen pavement. He wipes a hand across his face, leaving a smear of blood. Jen stares at his expression. Maybe he is regretful, maybe not. She can't tell. Jen can read almost everyone, but she never could read Todd. Day zero, just after 0100. Somebody must have called 999 because the street is suddenly lit up with bright blue orbs. What? Jen says to Todd. Jen's what conveys it all. Who? Why? What the fuck? Kelly releases his son, his face pale in shock, but he says nothing, as is often her husband's way. Todd doesn't look at her or at his father. Mom, he says eventually. Don't children always seek out their mother first? She reaches for him, but she can't leave the body. She can't release the pressure on the wounds. That might make it worse for everyone. Mom, he says again. His voice is fractured like dry ground that divides clean in two. He bites his lip and looks away down the street. Todd, she says. The man's blood is lapping over her hands like thick bathwater. I had to, he says to her, finally looking her way. Jen's jaw slackens in shock. Kelly's head drops to his chest. The sleeves of his dressing gown are covered in the blood from Todd's hands. Mate, Kelly says so softly Jen isn't sure he definitely spoke. Todd. I had to, Todd says again, more emphatically. He breathes out a contrail of steam into the freezing air. There was no choice, he says again, but this time with teenage finality. The blue of the police car pulses closer. Kelly is staring at Todd, his lips white with lack of blood, mime something, a silent profanity maybe. She stares at him, her son, this violent perpetrator who likes computers and statistics and, still, a pair of Christmas pyjamas each year, folded and placed at the end of his bed. Kelly turns in a useless circle on the driveway. His hands are in his hair. He hasn't looked at the man once. His eyes are only on Todd. Jen tries to stem the wounds that pulsate underneath her hands. She can't leave the victim. The police are here, but no paramedics yet. Todd is still trembling with the cold or the shock. She's not sure. Who is he? Jen asks him. She has so many more questions, but Todd shrugs, not answering. Jen wants to reach to him, to squeeze the answers out of him, but they don't come. They're going to arrest you, Kelly says in a low voice. A policeman is running towards them. Look, don't say anything, all right? We'll... Who is he? Jen says. It comes out too loudly, a shout in the night. She wills the police to slow down. Please, slow down. Just give us a bit of time. Todd turns his gaze back to her. I, he says, and for once he doesn't have a wordy explanation, no intellectual posturing, just nothing, a trailed-off sentence puffed into the damp air that hangs between them in their final moments before this becomes something bigger than their family. The officer arrives next to them, tall, black stab vest, white shirt, radio held in his left hand. Echo from Tango 245 at scene now. Ambo coming. Todd looks over his shoulder at the officer once, twice, then back at his mother. This is the moment. This is the moment, he explains, before they encroach completely with their handcuffs and their power. Jen's face is frozen, her hands hot with blood. She is just waiting, afraid to move, to lose eye contact. Todd is the one who breaks it. He bites his lip. Then stares at his feet, and that's it. Another policeman moves Jen away from the stranger's body, and she stands on her driveway in her trainers and pyjamas, hands wet and sticky, just looking at her son and then at her husband in his dressing gown, trying to negotiate with the justice system. She should be the one taking charge. She's the lawyer, after all. But she is speechless, totally bewildered, as lost as if she has just been deposited at the North Pole. "Can you confirm your name?" the first policeman says to Todd. Other officers get out of other cars like ants from a nest. Jen and Kelly step forward in one motion, but Todd does something then, just a tiny gesture. He moves his hand out to the side to stop them. "Todd Brotherhood," he says dully. "Can you tell me what happened?" the officer asks. "Hang on," Jen says, springing to life. "You can't interview him by the side of the road." "Let us all come to the station," Kelly says urgently, and... "Well, I stabbed him," Todd interrupts, gesturing to the man on the ground. He puts his hands back in his pockets and steps towards the policeman. "So I'm guessing you better arrest me." "Todd," Jen says, "stop talking." Tears are clogging her throat. This cannot be happening. She needs a stiff drink to go back in time to be sick. Her whole body begins to tremble out here in the absurd, confusing cold. "Todd Brotherhood, you do not have to say anything," the policeman says. "But it may harm your defence if you do not mention when questioned." Todd puts his wrists together willingly, like he is in a fucking movie, and he's cuffed, just like that, with a metallic click. His shoulders are up. He's cold. His expression is neutral, resigned even. Jen cannot stop staring at him. "You can't do that," Kelly says. "Is this a..." "Wait," Jen says, panicked, to the policeman. "We'll come. He's just a teen." "I'm 18, Todd says. "In there," the policeman says to Todd, pointing at the car, ignoring Jen. Into the radio, he says, "Echo from Tango 245, dry cell prep, please." "We'll follow you then," she says desperately. "I'm a lawyer," she adds, needlessly, though she hasn't a clue about criminal law. Still, even now in crisis, the maternal instinct burns as bright and as obvious as the pumpkin in the window. They just need to find out why he did it, get him off, then get him help. That is what they need to do. That is what they will do. "We'll come," she says. "We'll meet you at the station." The policeman finally meets her gaze. He looks like a model, cutouts beneath his cheekbones. God, it's such a cliché. But don't all coppers look so young these days? "Crosby Station," he says to her, then gets back into the car without another word, taking her son with him. The other officer stays with the victim over there. Jen can hardly bear to think about him. She glances just once, the blood, the expression on the policeman's face. She is sure the man is dead. She turns to Kelly, and she will never forget the look her stoic husband gives her just then. She meets his navy eyes. The world seems to stop turning just for a second, and in the quiet and the stillness, Jen thinks, Kelly looks how it is to be heartbroken. The police station has a white sign outside the front advertising itself to the public. Merseyside Police, Crosby. Behind it sits a squat 60s building, surrounded by a low brick wall. Tides of October leaves have been washed up against it. Jen pulls up outside, just on the double yellows, and stops the engine. Their son stabbed somebody. What does a parking ticket matter? Kelly gets out before the car is even stationary. He reaches, unconsciously, she thinks, behind him for her hand. She grasps it like it's a raft at sea. He pushes one of the double glass doors open, and they hurry in across a tired grey linoleum foyer. It smells old-fashioned inside, like schools, like hospitals, like care homes, institutions that require uniforms and crap food, the kind of places Kelly hates. "I will never," he'd said early on in their relationship, "join the rat race." "I'll talk to them," Kelly says shortly to Jen. He is trembling, but it doesn't seem to be from fear, rather than from anger. He is furious. "It's fine. I can lawyer up and do the initial..." "Where's the super?" Kelly barks to a bald officer managing reception, who has a signet ring on his little finger. Kelly's body language is different, legs spread widely, shoulders puffed up. Even Jen has only rarely seen him drop his guard like this. In a bored tone, the officer tells them to wait to be seen. "You've got 5 minutes," Kelly says, pointing to the clock before throwing himself into a chair across the foyer. Jen sits down next to him and takes his hand. His wedding ring is loose on his finger. He must be cold. They sit there, Kelly crossing and uncrossing his long legs, huffing, Jen saying nothing. An officer arrives in reception, speaking quietly into his phone. "It's the same crime as 2 days ago, a Section 18 wounding with intent. The victim was Nicola Williams, perpetrator AWOL." His voice is so low, Jen has to strain to hear. She sits, just listening. Section 18 wounding with intent is a stabbing. They must be talking about Todd, and a similar crime from 2 days ago. Eventually, the arresting officer emerges, the tall one with the cheekbones. Jen looks at the clock behind the desk. It's 3:30 or perhaps 4:30. She doesn't know whether it's British summertime in here still. It's disorientating. "Your son is staying with us tonight. We'll interview him soon." "Where? Back there?" Kelly says. Let me in." "You won't be able to see him," the officer says. "You are witnesses." Irritation flares within Jen. This sort of thing, exactly this, is why people hate the justice system. "It's like that, is it?" Kelly says acidly to the officer. He holds his hands up. "Sorry," the officer says mildly. "What? So we're enemies?" "Kelly," Jen says. "Nobody is anybody's enemy," the officer says. "You can speak to your son in the morning." "Where is the superintendent?" Kelly says. "You can speak to your son in the morning." Kelly leaves a loaded, dangerous silence. Jen has seen only a handful of people on the receiving end of these, but still, she doesn't envy the policeman. Kelly's fuse usually takes a long time to trip, but when it does, it's explosive. "I'll call someone," she says. "I know someone." She gets her phone out and begins shakily scrolling through her contacts. Criminal lawyers. She knows loads of them. The first rule of law is never to dabble in something you don't specialise in. The second is never to represent your family. "He has said he doesn't want one," the officer says. "He needs a solicitor. You shouldn't," she says. The officer raises his palms to her. Next to her, Jen can feel Kelly's temper brewing. "I'll just call one and then he can," she starts. "All right, let me back there," Kelly says, gesturing to the white door leading to the rest of the station. "That cannot be authorised," the officer says. "Fuck you," Kelly says. Jen stares at him in shock. The officer doesn't even dignify this with a response, just looks at Kelly in stony silence. "So what now then?" Jen says. God, Kelly has told a copper to fuck himself. A public order offence is not the way to defuse this situation. "As I've already told you, he'll remain with us overnight," the officer says to her plainly, ignoring Kelly. "I suggest you come back tomorrow." His eyes flick to Kelly. "You can't force your son to take a solicitor. We have tried." "But he's a kid," Jen says, though she knows that legally he isn't. "He's just a kid," she says again softly, mostly to herself, thinking of his Christmas pyjamas and the way he wanted her to sit up with him recently when he had a vomiting bug. They spent all night in the ensuite, chatting about nothing, her wiping his mouth with the damp flannel. "They don't care about that or anything," Kelly says bitterly. "We'll come back in the morning with the solicitor," Jen says, trying to ameliorate, to peacemake. "Feel free. We need to send a team back with you to the house now," he says. Jen nods wordlessly. Forensics, their house being searched, the lot. Jen and Kelly leave the police station. Jen rubs at her forehead as they go to the car and get in. She blasts the heat on as they sit there. "Are we really just going to go home?" she says. "Sit there while they search." Kelly's shoulders are tense. He stares at her, black hair everywhere, eyes sad like a poet's. "I have no fucking idea." Jen gazes out of the windscreen at a bush, glistening with middle-of-the-night autumnal dew. After a few seconds, she puts the car in reverse and drives because she doesn't know what else to do. The pumpkin greets them on the windowsill as she parks up. She must have left the candle burning. Forensics have already arrived in their white suits, standing on their driveway like ghosts by the police tape that flutters in the October wind. The puddle of blood has begun to dry at the edges. They're let in to their own fucking house, and they sit downstairs, watching the uniformed teams out front, some on their hands and knees doing fingertip searches of the crime scene. They say nothing at all, just hold hands in the silence. Kelly keeps his coat on. Eventually, when the scene of crime officers have gone and the police have searched and taken Todd's things, Jen shifts on the sofa so that she's lying down and stares up at the ceiling. And that's when the tears come. Hot and fast and wet. The tears for the future and the tears for yesterday and what she didn't see coming. Day minus one. 0800. Jen opens her eyes. She must have come up to bed, and she must have slept. She doesn't feel like she did either, but she's in her bedroom, not on the sofa, and it's now light outside beyond their slatted blinds. She rolls onto her side. Say it isn't true. She blinks, staring at the empty bed. She's alone. Kelly will already be up making calls, she very much hopes. Her clothes litter the bedroom floor, as if she evaporated out of them. She steps over them, pulling on jeans and a plain roll-neck jumper, which makes her look truly enormous, but that she loves anyway. She ventures out onto the hallway, standing outside Todd's empty room. Her son spent the night in a police cell. She can't think about how many more might await him. Right. She can sort this. Jen is an excellent rescuer, has spent all of her life doing just that, and now it's time to help her son. She can figure this out. Why did he do it? Why did he have a knife with him? Who was the victim? This grown man her son has probably killed. Suddenly, Jen can see little clues in Todd in the recent weeks and months. Moodiness, weight loss, secrecy. Things she had put down to teenagehood. Just 2 days ago, he had taken a call out in the garden. When Jen had asked who it was, he told her it was none of her business, then threw the phone onto the sofa. It had bounced once, then fallen to the floor, where they'd both looked at it. He'd passed it off as a joke, but it hadn't been, that small temper tantrum. Jen stares and stares at the door to her son's bedroom. How had she come to raise a murderer? Teenage rage, knife crime, gangs, Antifa. Which is it? Which hand have they been dealt? She can't hear Kelly at all. Halfway down the stairs, she glances out of the picture window, the window that she stood at only hours ago, the moment everything changed. It is still foggy. She is surprised to see the road below bears no stains. The rain and the mist must have washed the blood away. The police have moved on. The police tape has gone. She glances up the street, the edges peppered with trees ablaze with crunchy autumn leaves. But something is strange about what she sees. She can't work out what. It might just be the memories of last night, rendering the view sinister somehow. Slightly off. She hurries downstairs through their wooden-floored hallway and into the kitchen. It smells of last night in here, before anything happened. Food, candles, normality. She hears a voice right above her, a deep male register. Kelly. She looks at the ceiling, confused. He must be in Todd's room, searching it, probably. She understands that impulse entirely, the urge to find what the police couldn't. Kel? She calls out, running back up the stairs, out of breath by the time she reaches the top. We need to get on. Which solicitor we should... 3 score and Jen, a voice says. It comes from Todd's room and is unmistakably her son's. Jen takes a step back so massive it makes her stumble at the top of the stairs. And she's not imagining it. Todd emerges from the confines of his room wearing a black T-shirt which says Science Guy on it and jogging bottoms. He has clearly just woken and squints down at her, his pale face the only light in the darkness. We haven't done that one yet, he says with a dimpled grin. I must confess, went on a pun website. Jen can only gape at him, her son, the killer. There is no blood on his hands, no murderous expression on his face. And yet... What? She says. How are you here? Huh? He really does look just the same as he did. Even in her confusion, Jen is curious. Same blue eyes, same tousled black hair, same tall, slim frame. But he's committed an unforgivable act. Unforgivable to everyone except maybe her. How is he here? How is he home? What? He prompts. How did you get back? Todd's brow flickers. This is weird, even for you. Did Dad get you? Are you on bail? She barks. On bail? He raises an eyebrow, a new mannerism. For the past few months he's looked different, slimmer in the body and the hips, but bloated in the face, with the pallor somebody gets when they're working too much, eating too many takeaways and drinking no water. None of which Jen is aware Todd is doing, but who knows. And then along came this mannerism acquired just after he met his new girlfriend, Cleo. I'm about to meet Connor. Connor, a boy from his year, but another new friend made only this summer. Jen befriended his mum, Pauline, years ago. She is just Jen's sort of person. Jaded, sweary, not a natural mother, the kind of person who implicitly gives Jen permission to mess up. Jen has always been drawn to these types of people. All of her friends are unpretentious, unafraid to do and say what they think. Just recently, Pauline had said of Connor's younger brother Theo, I love him, but because he's 7, he often acts like a twat. They'd laughed like guilty loons at the school gate. Jen steps forwards and looks closely at Todd. No mark of the devil on him, no change behind his eyes, no weapons in the room beyond him. In fact, it looks untouched. How did you get home? And what happened? Home from where? The police station, Jen says plainly. She finds herself keeping a distance from him, just a step more than usual. She no longer knows what this person, her child, the love of her life, is capable of. Sorry? The police station, he says, evidently amused. Question mark? Todd's expression twists, nose wrinkling up just like it did when he was a baby. He has 2 tiny scars left over from the worst of his teenage acne. Otherwise, his face is still childlike, pristine in that beautiful peach fuzz way of the young. Your arrest, Todd. My arrest? Jen can usually tell when her son is lying, and at that moment she registers that he is definitely not. He looks at her with his clear twilight eyes, confusion inscribed across his features. What? She says in barely a whisper. Something is creeping up her spine, some tentative, frightening knowledge. I saw what you did. She gestures to the mid-landing window, and that's the moment she realizes what's the matter. It isn't the scene outside, it's the window itself. No pumpkin. It's gone. Jen's teeth begin to chatter. This can't be happening. She tears her eyes away from the pumpkinless windowsill. I saw, she says again. Saw what? His eyes are so like Kelly's, she finds herself thinking, for at least the 1,000th time in her life. They're identical. She just looks at him, and for once his gaze holds hers. What happened last night, after you got back?
I wasn't out last night.
The banter, the pretension, the posturing are all gone. What?
I was waiting up for you. You were late, but then the clocks changed.
He pauses, maintaining eye contact.
The clocks go back tomorrow. It's Friday today.
Day minus 1, 08:20.
Some internal elevator plunges down the center of Jen's chest. She pushes her hair off her face and heads to the family bathroom at the back of the house, holding up a finger to Todd for just a second. She shivers as she turns her back on him, like he is a predator she wants to keep an eye on. She is sick into the toilet, the sort of sick she hasn't been in years. Hardly anything comes up, just a sticky yellow stomach acid that sits right at the bottom of the water. She thinks of her pregnancy when she told a doctor she was vomiting so much that only bile was coming up, and he apparently felt the need to say, "Bile is bright green and signals real trouble. You mean stomach acid." She stares and stares into the acid lining the bottom of the toilet. It might not be bile, but she thinks she might be in real trouble. Todd does not know what she is talking about, that is clear. Even he wouldn't deny this, but why? How? The pumpkin. The pumpkin is missing. Where is her husband? She can't think straight. Panic rises up through her body, a great pressure with nowhere to go. She's going to be sick again. She sits on the cold checkerboard tiles. She gets her phone out of her pocket and stares at it, bringing up the calendar. It is Friday, the 28th of October. The clocks do indeed go back tomorrow. Monday will be Halloween. Jen stares and stares at that date. How can this be? She must be going mad. She gets up and paces uselessly. Her body feels like it's covered in ants. She's got to get out of here, but out of where? Out of yesterday? She navigates to her last text message with Kelly and presses call. He answers immediately. "Look," she says urgently. "Uh-oh," he says, languid, always amused by her. She hears a door close. "Where are you?" she asks. She knows she sounds crazed, but she can't help it. A beat. "I am on planet Earth, but it sounds like you might not be." "Be serious. I'm at work, obviously. Where are you?" "Was Todd arrested last night?" "What?" She hears him put something heavy down on a hollow-sounding floor. For what?" "No, I'm asking you, was he?" "No," Kelly says, sounding baffled. Jen can't believe it. Sweat blooms across her chest. She starts to rub at her arms. "But we sat in the police station. You shouted at them. The clocks had just gone back. I had done the pumpkin." "Look, are you okay? I need to finish Merrylocks," he says. Jen sucks a breath in. "He said he finished there yesterday, didn't he?" "Yes, she's sure he did. He was at the top of the landing, wearing only a tattoo and a smile. She can remember it. She can." She puts a hand to her eyes as if she can block out the world. "I don't know what's going on," she says. She starts to cry, water lacing her words. "What did we do last night?" She leans her head back against the wall. "Did I do the pumpkin?" "What are you?" "I think I've had some sort of episode," she says in barely a whisper. She rolls her pajamas up over her knees and stares at her skin. No impressions where she knelt on the gravel, not a single speck of dirt on them, no blood under her nails. Goosebumps erupt up and down her arms fast like a time-lapse. "Did I carve the pumpkin?" she asks again, but as she speaks, some deep realization is dawning all around her. If it didn't happen, she might have lost her mind. But her son isn't a murderer. She feels her shoulders drop just slightly in relief. "No, you said you couldn't be asked," he says with a little laugh. "Right," she says faintly, picturing exactly how that pumpkin turned out. She stands and stares at herself in the mirror. She meets her own eyes. She is a portrait of a panicked woman, dark hair, pale complexion, hunted eyes. "Look, I'd better go," she says. "I'm sure it was a dream," she says, though how can it be? "Okay," Kelly says slowly. Perhaps he is about to say something but decides against it, because he says only, "Okay," again, then adds, "I'll leave early," and Jen is glad he is this, a family man, not the kind of man who goes to pubs or plays sport with friends, just her Kelly. She leaves the bathroom and goes down to the kitchen. Mist shrouds the garden beyond their patio doors, erasing the tops of the trees to nothing. Kelly built this kitchen for them a couple of years ago, after she had said, drunk, that she wanted to be the kind of woman who has her shit together, you know? Happy clients, a happy kid, a Belfast sink. He presented it to her one evening. Expect to imminently have your shit together, Jen, because you've got the sink of your dreams here. The memory fades. Jen always advises her stressed trainees to take 10 deep breaths and make a coffee, so that's what she will do herself. She's trained for this. 2 decades in a high-pressure job does give you some skills. But as she approaches their marble kitchen island, her footsteps slow. A whole, uncarved pumpkin sits on the side. She stops dead. It may as well be a ghost. Jen thinks she might be sick again. Oh, she says to nobody, a tiny slip of a word, a giant syllable of understanding. She approaches the pumpkin as though it is an unexploded bomb and turns it around, but it's whole underneath her fingertips, firm and unharmed. And Jesus Christ, last night didn't happen. It didn't fucking happen. Relief laps over her. He didn't do it. He didn't do it. She listens to Todd in his room, opening and closing drawers, footsteps back and forth, the sound of a zip. Back in the real world yet, he says, arriving in the hallway at the bottom of the stairs. His arch tone makes Jen jump. She stares at him, his body. He is slimmer than he was a few weeks ago, isn't he? Almost, she says automatically. She swallows twice. Her back feels shivery, like she's ill, adrenaline burning a kind of feverish panic. Well, good. I guess I had a horrible dream. Oh, bummer, Todd says simply, as though something could explain her confusion so easily. Yeah, but look, in it, you killed somebody. Wow, he says, but something shifts just slightly beneath the surface of his expression, like a fish swimming deep in an ocean, unseen apart from the ripples created by it. Who? He says, which Jen thinks is a strange initial question. She is accustomed to seeing clients not tell the complete truth, and that is what this looks like to her. He reaches to pull his dark hair back from his forehead. His t-shirt rides up, exposing the waist she used to hold when he was tiny and wriggly, just learning to sit up, to bounce, to walk. She'd thought motherhood was so boring at the time, so unrewarding. The hours and hours dedicated to the same tasks in a variety of orders. But it wasn't, she now knows. To say so is like saying breathing is boring. A grown man, like a 40-year-old. With these puny limbs, Todd says, holding a slim arm up theatrically. Kelly once said to her late at night, how did we come to raise an overconfident geek? And they'd had to muffle their giggles. Kelly's dry wit is the thing Jen loves the most about him. She's so glad Todd has inherited it. Even with those, she says, but she thinks, you didn't need muscle, you had a weapon. Todd shoves his bare feet into a pair of trainers. Right as he does it, Jen remembers this taking place on Friday morning. She'd marvelled at how he didn't feel the October chill, worried his ankles would get cold at school, worried too, shamefully, that people would think she was a shit mother, that she was... what, exactly? Anti-socks? Jesus, the thing she stresses over. But she had. She remembers. A frisson moves across her shoulders. Todd grabs the door handle, and Jen recalls the déjà vu. No, she's fine. She's fine. Don't worry about it. Forget it. There's no evidence any of it happened. Until there is. I'm going straight to Cleo's after school, if she'll have me. I'll eat there. His tone is short. He's telling her, not asking her, the way it's been lately. And that is when it happens. The words are on Jen's lips, as natural as a spring bubbling from the earth, the exact same sentence she uttered yesterday. More oysters in buckets, she says. The first time Todd went to Cleo's for dinner, they'd had actual oysters. He'd sent her a photo of one, its entrance prized open, balanced on the tips of his fingers, captioned, "You said I needed to open up more?" She waits for Todd's reply, that he's pretty sure they will have something low-key, like foie gras. He flashes her a grin, which cuts through the tension. "I'm pretty sure we'll just have something low-key, like, you know, foie gras." She cannot. She cannot deal with this. This is madness. Her heart feels like it's going to pound itself into a cardiac arrest. Todd picks up his bag. Something about the movement of it thumping onto his shoulder unnerves her further. It looks heavy. The thought arrives, fully formed, right then. What if the weapon is in that bag? What if the crime is going to happen? What if it wasn't a dream, but a premonition? Jen goes hot and then cold. "Was that your computer I heard?" she says, eyes to the ceiling. "It made a noise." It's laughably easy to make a teenager go to check a device, and Jen feels a guilty pathos for just a second as she watches his feet trip over each other in his rush to go and investigate. It's habitual, a residual sympathy she's always felt for Todd. Too much at times, getting involved with schoolgate drama when he was left out of any social occasion. But today it feels misplaced. She's seen him kill. Whatever it is she feels, it isn't enough to stop her looking. Front pockets, side pockets, it's a good distraction to be taking action. She hears Todd humming upstairs in that way that he does when he's impatient. "Sake," he says. Two chemistry textbooks, three loose pens. Jen puts them on the hallway floor and continues searching. "No notifications," he shouts. His voice is irritated again. Just recently she's felt like a nuisance around him. "Sorry," she calls, thinking, "Give me one fucking minute, just one, just one. Must have misheard." The bottom of the bag is lined with the crumbs from 1,000 sandwiches. But what's this? Right in the back. A sheath. A leather sheath. It's as cold and hard as a thigh bone, sitting right there against the back of her son's rucksack. She knows what it will be before she pulls it out. A long leather pouch. She exhales, then unbuttons the top and slides a handle out. And inside it, a knife. The knife. Day minus one, 08:30. Jen stands there staring at it, at this betrayal in her hand. She hadn't thought what she would do if she found something. She never thought she would. She holds the long, sinister black handle. The panic begins again, a tide of anxiety that goes out to sea but always, always returns. She wrenches open the understairs cupboard. Shoes and sports equipment and canned goods they can't fit in the kitchen crowd out, and she fumbles past them, pushing the knife right to the back. She can hear Todd on the landing. She leans the knife against the back wall and retreats out of the cupboard, tidying up the rest of his things back into the bag. Todd, disgruntled smile, young Kelly written across his features, picks up the bag. He doesn't seem to notice the difference, the lightness of it. Jen stares at him as he opens the front door. Her son, armed, so he thinks, and with intent. Her son who thrust that knife with such force it split another person's torso right open in three places. He throws a look over his shoulder, suspicious, and Jen thinks for a second that he might know what she's done. He leaves and Jen climbs the stairs and watches his car from the picture window. As he drives off, she's sure she sees his eyes flick up to the rearview mirror and meet hers for just the briefest of moments. Like a butterfly landing and leaving before you even notice, flapping its wings only once. "I found a knife in Todd's bag," Jen says, the second her husband arrives home. She doesn't explain the rest, not yet. She spent the day swinging between panic and rationalization. It was nothing, it was a dream, it's something, it's a living nightmare. She's mad, she's mad, she's mad. Kelly's face shuts down immediately as Jen expected it might. He approaches her, picking the blade up and holding it across his hands as if it is some kind of archaeological find. His pupils have gone huge. What did he say when you found it? His tone is frosty. He doesn't know. Kelly nods, staring down at the long, sharp blade, not saying anything. Jen remembers his angry behaviour from last night and thinks that now he just looks withdrawn instead. It's a brand new knife, he says now, flicking his eyes to her. I'm gonna fucking kill him. I know. Unused. Jen laughs, a hard, unhumorous laugh. Right. What? It's just, I mean, I saw Todd stab somebody with this last night. What? He says, the word not lilting upwards, not a question, just a statement of disbelief. Yesterday, I waited up for Todd and he knifed someone on the street. You were there too. But, Kelly rubs a hand over his chin. But I wasn't. You weren't. You said that was a dream. He flashes her a quick smile. Have you gone to Madtown? He says, their abbreviation for neuroses. Jen turns away from him. Outside, their neighbour walks his dog past. Jen knows his phone is about to ring, remembers it from yesterday, but it does so before she can say it to Kelly. She needs to think of something else that's about to happen, to prove it to Kelly, but she can't. She can't think of anything except how she has woken up here, in some alternative, scary universe. I was awake, she says, turning her gaze from the neighbour, thinking of all of the items that would be considered circumstantial evidence that yesterday didn't happen. The smooth, uncut pumpkin, her son's presence in the bedroom, the absence of any blood or police tape on the street outside. But then she thinks of the knife. That knife is the only piece of tangible proof she has. Look, I didn't see anything last night. We'll just ask him about it. When he gets back, Kelly says. It's a criminal offence, so we can tell him that. Jen nods, saying nothing. What can she possibly say? Get out from under my feet, Kelly says. He is addressing their cat, Henry VIII, so called because he has been obese from the day they rescued him. Jen, lounging on the sofa in their kitchen, winces. Kelly said exactly the same thing on Friday night. The first Friday night. He gave in then, fed Henry, said, fine, but know that I am judging you. She gets to her feet and paces past Kelly. She can't just sit here and let a day play out that she's already lived. Where are you off to? Kelly says to her, amused. You look so stressed you actually just created a breeze as you came past me. Then to the meowing cat, fine, but know that I am judging you. He opens a packet of Felix. Heat travels up Jen's chest. She can feel a panicked blush rise through her neck and to her cheeks. This all happened, she says. This has all happened before. What's going on? She sits down on the sofa and pulls uselessly at her clothes, trying to escape her own body, trying to express something impossible. If she hadn't already lost her mind, she certainly looks as though she has now. The knife? Not the knife. I only found the knife today, she says, knowing that this won't make any sense to anyone but her. Everything else. I have experienced everything else that's happening. I have lived this day twice now. Kelly sighs as he finishes feeding Henry and opens the freezer door. This is mad, even for you, he says sardonically. Jen tilts her head, looking up at him from her position on the sofa. They'd argued the first time they lived this night about holidays, Jen always wanting to go on them, Kelly refusing to fly. A plane he was on once dropped 5,000 feet during turbulence. He told her early on in their relationship he's not flown since. You're not remotely an anxious person, Jen had said. Well, I am about this, he'd said before getting a Magnum out of the freezer. I know you're about to eat a Magnum, she says now, but Kelly's hand is already on the freezer. However did you guess that? He says. She's a psychic, he says to the cat. Kelly leaves the kitchen. She knows he will go upstairs to shower. as he walks past her, he trails his fingers so lightly along her upper back that it makes her shiver. She meets his eyes. "You're fine," he says. She wishes she hadn't been so anxious in the past. She raises her hand to grasp his just as he's leaving, as she has a thousand times before. His hand is her anchor, a woman alone out at sea, and then he's gone. If he is worried about the knife or what she's been saying, he doesn't say. It isn't his style. Jen puts on Grey's Anatomy and leans back on the sofa, alone, trying to relax. Jen and Kelly met almost 20 years ago. He walked into her father's law firm, asking if they wanted any decorating done. Jeans slung low on his waist, a slow, knowing smile when his eyes landed on Jen. Her father had turned him down, but Jen had gone for lunch with him, more by accident than anything else. He'd walked out with her at 12 o'clock, and they'd seen the rain-slicked pub opposite had a 2-for-1 offer on. All through the lunch, then pudding, then coffee, Jen kept saying she ought to get back. But they seemed to have so much to say to each other. Kelly asked her interested question after interested question. He's the best listener she knows. She remembers almost everything about that date. It had been late March, absurdly cold and wet, and yet, as Jen sat there at a little table in the corner of a pub with Kelly, the sun had come out from behind the dense cloud, just for a minute or two, and illuminated them. And right then, it had felt suddenly like spring, even though it began to rain again only minutes later. They'd shared an umbrella from the pub back to the office. She'd let him leave with it, a totally deliberate act, and when he'd brought it into the office the following Monday, he left his keys on her desk. That date has come to define Jen's sense of time. Each March, she feels it. The smell of a daffodil, the way the sun slants sometimes, green and fresh. An open window reminds her of them in bed together, their legs entwined together, their torsos separate, like two happy mermaids. Each spring she's back there, rainy March, with him. Jen finds comfort now watching Grey's Anatomy, as she has many times, in the cardiothoracic wing of the Seattle Grace Hospital and in taking off her bra. Maybe this is her fault, she thinks, watching the television, but not really watching it too. She always found motherhood so hard. It had been such a shock, such a vast reduction in the time available to her. She did nothing well, not work, nor parenting. She put out fires in both for what felt like a decade straight, has only recently emerged. But maybe the damage is already done. It's a dream, that's all, she tells herself. Yes. Conviction fires up through her chest. Of course, it was a dream. She turns Grey's Anatomy off. The news replaces it automatically. She remembers this segment about Facebook privacy settings being reviewed. The next one will be about an epilepsy drug being tested on laboratory mice. It's hardly proof of time travel, but nevertheless, it pops up. A new trial of a drug in the... Jen turns off the television, leaves the kitchen and goes into the hallway. Upstairs, the shower is running, just like she knew it would be. She's got to be able to use this stuff to convince somebody, surely. She gets the knife out of the downstairs cupboard and inspects it. Unused, just as Kelly said. She sits on the bottom stair, waiting for Todd, the knife across her lap, waiting up for him once more, but this time she's waiting for an explanation. Waiting for the truth. I found this, Jen says. And something small and spiteful within her is glad to be having a new conversation, and not one she has lived before. She extends the knife out to Todd. He doesn't take it. There are a million tells. His brow drops. He licks his lips. He shifts his weight on his feet. He says nothing and everything. It's a mate's, he says, eventually. That is the oldest lie in the book, Jen says. Do you know how many times lawyers have heard that? She swallows down more stomach acid. His shiftiness has confirmed it for her. It happens. It happens tomorrow. What are you doing, gulping like that? Todd says with an indolent shrug. This is how he has been lately, Jen finds herself thinking, as she stares at the floor and tries not to be sick again. A boy full of secrets. She finds his shrugging presence sinister now, tonight. I'll speak to him, Kelly says from the top of the stairs. She thought they'd got away without this stuff happening, this teenage stuff. Todd was an easy baby, a happy child. The only drama they'd had over this last summer was when a girl, Gemma, dumped him for being too weird. He'd come home heartbroken, not spoken for a full 24 hours, leaving Jen and Kelly guessing. He'd sat on Jen's bed the next evening when Kelly was out, crossed his legs, told her what happened, and asked if she thought it was true. Absolutely not, she'd said, while guiltily wondering if there was a way to tell him, well, maybe? Not too weird, but definitely nerdy. He'd shown her some of the messages he'd sent. Intense was the word for them. Long missives, science memes, poems, text after text after text without a reply. Gemma had clearly been cooling off. Thanks for that. Chat tomorrow. Nah, bit busy today. And Jen had winced for her son. But now this. Knives, murders, arrests. Kelly is silently appraising his son, his head tilted slightly backwards. Jen wishes he'd blow up, escalate things somehow, but evidently he decides not to. Todd looks suddenly angry, his jaw is fixed. He holds his palms up but says nothing more. So, if I check your bank statements, you didn't buy it. It won't appear there, Kelly asks. Todd calls his bluff, looking levelly up the stairs. After a few seconds, he breaks eye contact with his father, shrugs himself out of his coat. He kicks his trainers off, feet bare on the floorboards. That's right, he says, his back to Jen, as he hangs his coat up, something he never usually does. We understand, you know, wanting to feel protected, Kelly says. Look, come with me, take a walk. Do we understand that? Jen says. She looks up at him in surprise. Todd turns violently away from her, running the rest of the way up the stairs and pushing past Kelly. What do you think I'm going to do? Kill you? Todd says so softly, Jen wonders if she's misheard. Her whole body heaves. Unless you tell me where you got it and why, you won't be going anywhere. Not for days. Not even to school, she says. Fine, Todd shouts. He goes into his bedroom, the door slamming so hard it shakes the whole house. Jen stares at Kelly, feeling like she's been slapped. Kelly runs a hand through his hair. Fucking hell, he says to her. What a mess. He swipes at the cabinet that stands at the top of their stairs. A piece of paper falls off it, which he picks up, rubbing at his forehead. That piece of paper is an offer of a big job, one Kelly refused because they wanted him to go on their payroll rather than stay self-employed, and he'd said he'd never do that. What's happened to him? She says. I don't know, Kelly snaps. He shakes his head. Let's fucking leave it. He isn't directing the anger at her, Jen knows. It's his temper, sudden and volatile when it eventually goes. He once exploded at a man in a bar who touched Jen's arse, said he'd be happy to see him outside, which Jen couldn't believe. She nods now, too choked up to speak, too panicked with what she fears is to come. We can deal with, Kelly waves a hand, all this tomorrow. Jen nods, happy to be directed. She takes the knife upstairs with her and puts it underneath their bed. She and Todd cross paths later that evening, he coming down for a drink, she about to go upstairs for the night. She'd ordinarily be in a whirlwind of laundry and other banal tasks, but she isn't tonight. She's just watching him across the kitchen without the busyness of normal life surrounding them. He fills a glass from the tap, downs it in one, then fills it again. He pulls his phone out and scrolls on it while sipping, half smiles at something, then puts it back in his pocket. She pretends to occupy herself. Todd strides past, glass of water still in hand, but just before he goes upstairs, he checks the lock on the front door. He gets one step up the stairs, turns around, then checks it again, just to be sure. It looks like a check undertaken out of fear. Her skin feels chilled as she watches. As she falls asleep, she finds herself thinking that Todd is here, safe in their house, grounded, and she has the knife. Perhaps it has been stopped, whatever it is. Perhaps she will wake and it will be tomorrow, the day after. Anything but today again.